Chapter 11. The Stolen Elections of 2000, 2004, and almost 2008. The Incident. In 2000 and again in 2004, George W. Bush won two closely contested presidential elections against Democratic contenders Al Gore and John Kerry. The official word. The Supreme Court stopped a recount in Florida in 2000. Giving Bush an Electoral College victory on December 12. In 2004, Bush took the deciding state of Ohio by a 100,000-vote margin and gained a second term. My take? Both elections were stolen by Republican operatives, above all through manipulation of the electronic voting machines in deciding states, where votes were shifted from one candidate to the other. A guy who might have blown the whistle was killed in a plane crash right after the 2008 election. If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier, just so long as I'm the dictator. George W. Bush, CNN, December 18, 2000. We all know what happened back in 2000 when the Supreme Court handed George W. Bush the presidency by ordering the vote recount stopped in Florida. Al Gore had won the popular vote nationwide by about 500,000 votes, but couldn't get a majority in the Electoral College without Florida. A lot of us also suspect that John Kerry actually won the presidency in 2004, except for Ohio's Republican Secretary of State manipulating the vote totals there in Bush's favor. Would it surprise you to learn that massive conspiracies were involved in both those elections, and that the Republicans were on the verge of trying to steal it again in 2008? The main reason they didn't was because their key vote stealer got forced into a court deposition the day before the election, only to die in the crash of his private plane a little more than a month later. His name was Michael Connell. He was Karl Rove's IT, information technology guy, whose computer handiwork helped swing Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004 for Bush. We'll get to Connell's story later in the chapter, including some new information that's never been published before. But let's start with a look back at what happened in 2000. It was around 2:15 a.m. Eastern Time, when Fox News led the network's charge in projecting Bush the winner. The fellow who started this was John Ellis. He headed up Fox's decision team and just happened to be the cousin of W. and Jeb, who just happened to be the governor of Florida. "Jebby says we got it! Jebby says we got it!" Ellis was heard shouting as he got off the phone with his Florida cousin. And it didn't take more than a couple of minutes before Fox called it that way. And within 4 minutes after that, like bleeding sheep, NBC, CBS, ABC, and CNN followed suit. That was when Gore made his phone call to Bush conceding the election, although he reconsidered as the Florida results suddenly tightened up. Obviously, there was nepotism involved in Fox News's decision. CBS later said that a critical factor in its own call for Bush was the vote count in Florida's Volusia County, where it turned out that more than 16,000 votes had been subtracted from Gore's total by the electronic voting machines. One of Gore's campaign staff got suspicious and found out he was actually ahead in Volusia by 13,000 votes. That's when Gore took back his concession. Later on, the mistake was tracked to a company called Global Election Systems. 2 months after the election, an internal memo from their master programmer, Talbot Iredale, blamed the problem on a memory card that had been uploaded improperly and unnecessarily. Iredale said, "There is always the possibility that the second memory card, or second upload, came from an unauthorized source." That phrase, unauthorized source, kind of raises a red flag, doesn't it? This faulty memory card was pretty much forgotten once everybody started talking about hanging that the second memory card, or second upload, came from an unauthorized source. That phrase, unauthorized source, kind of raises a red flag, doesn't it? This faulty memory card was pretty much forgotten once everybody started talking about hanging chads and butterfly ballots. Now, I myself am pretty much computer illiterate, but my wife is not. She's not a person that swears often, but every day when she's on the computer, I'm listening to her cuss. That speaks volumes to me on a basic level. It tells me that computers often screw up, because let's face it, they're still made by humans, and we're going to make mistakes. So they can be manipulated. When you see all the identity fraud that goes on today, how easy would it be to create voter fraud? It's ripe. I believe all votes should still be paper ballots and hand-counted. I'm proud to say Minnesota is still that way, and I hope this never changes. Look at it like this. Would you use an ATM machine that didn't give you a receipt? Well, these electronic voting machines don't do that. There's no way to keep a record of who you voted for, so there can't be a valid recount. When computers can be used to change votes, it changes the legality of our system. The only way to change that is to go back and make it as primitive as you can. One person, one vote. Changing the vote electronically was far from the only scam going down in Florida in 2000. Journalist Greg Palast was reporting soon after the election about how Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush set out to do some ethnic cleansing on the voter rolls ahead of time. You see, Florida has a state law that convicted felons aren't allowed to vote, so they hired a private contractor called Database Technologies, DBT, a division of Choice Point, whose board was studded with Republican bigwigs, to look for any crooks who were also registered voters. The database eventually listed 57,700 Florida citizens, and local election supervisors were told to purge them. Except, more than 90% of those people had never committed any felonies. More than half of them were either black or Hispanic and likely to have voted for a Democrat. Early in 2001, when the U.S. Civil Rights Commission became the only agency to look into how Florida handled the disputed election, it concluded there had been a possible conspiracy by Catherine Harris and others. Besides denying the so-called felons their voting rights, Jeb Bush had ordered state troopers near the polling sites to delay people for hours while they searched their cars. Two photo IDs were required at some precincts, even though Florida law only required one. In certain black precincts, ballot boxes disappeared or ended up found later in strange places, never having been collected. This story ran big in the media, but only across the Atlantic in England. Palast tried to get it into the American media in the weeks when the recount was still happening. CBS told him it didn't seem to hold up. Why? Well, because they'd called Jeb Bush's office to ask. The Washington Post did run a page one story, but not until June of 2001, even though they'd had the story 7 months earlier, when it might have made a difference. Our media should be ashamed of their part in undermining American democracy. You had a newsman like Tim Russert saying the day after the election that it was probably time for Gore to play statesman and concede. Did you ever hear of any media suggesting that Bush call it a day? Not a one. The dirty tricks just kept on happening. Remember how both sides fought about the counting of absentee ballots from overseas? One Republican operative says there was a long conference call after the election where Bush's boys talked about having some people near overseas military bases organize a little get-out-the-vote drive. They'd be registered voters, of course, but just happened to have forgotten to cast their ballot on Election Day. So what if it was a few days later? As of November 13th, a total of 446 military absentee ballots had arrived. By the 17th, the number had soared to 3,733. Raise any eyebrows that Maybe somebody should have been charged with a felony? I get a sense of deja vu when I see what's happened more recently with the disruptors of the Obama administration's town hall meetings on health care. There was a manual recount underway in Miami-Dade County when dozens of screaming GOP demonstrators shipped in from Washington started banging on doors and a picture window at the election headquarters. Several people got trampled, punched, or kicked. Gore had already received a net gain of 168 votes when the canvassing board panicked and stopped the recount. Most of the mob ended up receiving nice rewards within the Republican Party. So on December 12th, just when a Florida district court judge was about to order a complete statewide hand recount, the Supreme Court rendered its decision. Justice Anthony Scalia said he thought that to keep on counting would threaten irreparable harm to the petitioner, Bush, and to the country by casting a cloud upon what he claims to be the legality of his decision. What legality? I have never understood what precedents the Supreme Court used in doing this. You had a branch of federal government stepping in and interfering with what should be completely a state's rights issue. The Fed should have no dog in the fight. I agree with Vince Bugliosi, who wrote that the justices who did this should be put in jail for overstepping their bounds. After it was too late, the Washington Post published a piece about how if all the votes had been recounted in all 67 counties, Gore would probably have been in the White House. A study cited by CBS and AP, conducted by the University of Chicago, reported, "Under any standard that tabulated all disputed votes statewide, Gore erased Bush's advantage, and won by a narrow margin." Ho-hum, I guess the deal was already done. Of course, Gore won the national popular vote from the get-go. How can you get 500,000 more votes than the other guy and lose? The presidential is the only election where we allow that to happen. We should have gotten rid of the Electoral College long ago. It was fine back in the days when everybody was still on horseback. We now have cars and aeroplanes, and it's time to leave an antiquated system behind. Who's profiting from keeping it going? As a third-party guy, I was hoping 2004 would bring the opposite result. Bush would win the popular vote, and Kerry would take the electoral. Maybe that would have brought them to the table to abolish the whole thing. But 2004, it turned out, was even more blatant election theft than in 2000. The exit polls were predicting a huge victory for Kerry, but by late that night, somehow, Bush had taken a decisive lead and Kerry conceded on the day after. "There is no evidence of vote theft or errors on a large scale," the New York Times informed us. The Washington Post called any talk of vote fraud conspiracy theories. Bull crap. For starters, here's what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. later documented. Nearly half of the 6 million American voters living abroad never received their ballots, or received them too late to vote, after the Pentagon unaccountably shut down a state-of-the-art website used to file overseas registrations. A consulting firm called Sproul and Associates, which was hired by the Republican National Committee to register voters in 6 battleground states, was discovered shredding Democratic registrations. In New Mexico, which was decided by 5,988 votes, malfunctioning machines mysteriously failed to properly register a presidential vote on more than 20,000 ballots. Nationwide, according to the Federal Commission charged with implementing election reforms, as many as 1 million ballots were spoiled by faulty voting equipment, roughly one for every 100 cast. The electronic voting machines played an even bigger role in the 2004 election, with 36 million votes being cast on the touchscreen systems owned by 4 private companies that use their own proprietary software. 3 of those companies had close ties to the Republican Party, One of them, Diebold, including employees and their families, had contributed at least $300,000 to GOP candidates and party funds since 1998. The company's CEO, Walden O'Dell, had gone so far in a fundraising email as to promise to deliver Ohio to Bush in 2004. With enemies like that, Kerry could have used a few friends demanding a return to paper ballots. Ohio was where Bush's victory put him over the top in the Electoral College. From 12:20 in the morning until around 2 a.m., the flow of information in Ohio mysteriously stopped, while the vote count switched dramatically to Bush's side. A comfortable 118,000 vote plus official margin in Ohio then gave him a second term as president. But what really went down? Officials there purged tens of thousands of eligible voters from the rolls, neglected to process registration cards generated by Democratic voter drives, shortchanged Democratic precincts when they allotted voting machines, and illegally derailed a recount that could have given Kerry the presidency. Lou Harris, who basically invented modern political polling, said, "Ohio was as dirty an election as America has ever seen." The fellow in charge of the vote counting was Ohio Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell, who also happened to be the co-chair of Bush's re-election committee there. And nobody seemed concerned about a conflict of interest? Back in 2000, Blackwell had been Bush's principal electoral system advisor during the Florida recount, where I guess he took some lessons from Catherine Harris. When Congressman John Conyers looked into what took place in Ohio, his report in January 2005 set forth massive and unprecedented voter irregularities and anomalies in Ohio, caused by intentional misconduct and illegal behavior, much of it involving Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell. Conyers told RFK Jr. that Blackwell made Catherine Harris look like a cupcake. Playing devil's advocate for a minute, I heard from a Democratic friend who worked Ohio that they just didn't get the people out to vote like they should have. And I think the Democratic Party blew the 2004 election to the point where it shouldn't have come down to Ohio. Why did they allow the Republicans to twist things around and make George Bush a war hero when he was actually a draft dodger? And then turn Kerry, who fought valiantly in Vietnam, into a coward? I would never have handled it that way. Let's pull our military records and compare them. Find out who was the real guy serving his country. I can't understand why the Democrats allowed this to take place. But maybe Kerry had played too many games of compromise over his years in politics. He told my collaborator Dick Russell in 2008, and I quote, "I know I won the election, but by the time my lawyers could come up with a smoking gun in Ohio, it was too late." My question is, how come Kerry has never come out publicly and talked about that? Doesn't he think he has a responsibility to try and stop history from repeating again? The story of what went on behind the scenes in Ohio really started to surface as we approached the next presidential election in 2008. That's where things get interesting. To set the stage, we need to go back to a lawsuit brought by a group of citizens against Ohio officials in August of 2006. At the time, Blackwell was still Secretary of State and was running for governor on the Republican ticket. A well-known voting rights attorney named Cliff Arnbeck set out to charge Blackwell and his cronies with election fraud, vote dilution, vote suppression, recount fraud, and other violations. The judge in the case followed up with a court order that all ballot evidence relating to the 2004 election be preserved for another year, beyond the legally required 22 months, which was about to expire. After Democrats swept into the major Ohio offices in 2006, the judge ordered everything turned over to the new Secretary of State, a woman named Jennifer Bruner. Well, guess what? The Board of Elections in 56 of Ohio's 88 counties had either lost, shredded, or dumped nearly 1.6 million ballots and other election records. The reasons? Oh, various things. Spilled coffee, a flooded storage area, some miscommunication with greenies there to pick up recyclables. All accidental. Sorry about that. There were a lot of discussions after that between lawyer Cliff Arnbeck and government officials. They talked about a settlement or grand jury investigation or Congress getting involved. Secretary of State Bruner wanted to focus on assuring the integrity of the next election rather than be distracted by the past. So Arnbeck agreed to narrow things to taking the deposition of one man, Michael Connell, who was Karl Rove's computer expert and lived in Akron, Ohio. A friend of Connell's named Stephen Spoonamore had already decided to go public. Arnbeck says Spoonamore is the best expert witness I've ever worked with, courageous and willing to take complex facts and circumstances and give you highly qualified, credible judgments. His friends call him Spoon, and he's an expert in electronic data security and what's called digital network architecture. He'd designed or consulted on computer systems for MasterCard, American Express, the State Department, and many more companies and government agencies. A registered Republican, Spoonamore was a staunch believer in the democratic process. Knowing plenty about how thieves could hack information, he'd been concerned about the prospects for fraud with electronic voting machines since the late 1990s. Spoonamore also happened to live in Ohio, and on election night 2004 was doing some monitoring when he began noticing trends in a number of Ohio counties where Kerry started out ahead, but then radically different totals ended up favoring Bush. Spoonamore started thinking about the possibility of a kingpin attack, where a computer inserted into the communications flow has the ability to change information at both ends of an IT system. It's Greek to me, but for you geeks out there, it's also known as the man-in-the-middle plan. Based on the Internet Protocol IP addresses that were registering, Spoonamore figured out that the same server form was used by the GOP for most of their hosting, and that tracked back to a company in Chattanooga, Tennessee, called SmartTech. Here's an excerpt from the Chattanooga Daily Paper from March 2004. Along the information superhighway, the road to another term in the White House for George Bush begins in Chattanooga. From a second-story suite in the Pioneer Bank building on Broad Street, millions of Internet connections and email blasts by the president's re-election campaign are regularly broadcast by SmartTech, Incorporated. The company was run by Jeff Averbeck, an Internet entrepreneur who first began working as a consultant for the Republican National Committee in 2000. Lawyers made a Freedom of Information Act request that confirms what Spoonamore uncovered. In November 2003, Blackwell's office had enlisted a company called GovTech Solutions, owned by Mike Connell, to establish a duplicate control center for Election Day 04. The results would be sent directly to subcontractor SmartTech and its backup server out in Tennessee. The contract specified that there would be a hardware VPN device that will allow access to a private network connecting the servers for database replication services as well as remote administration. Meaning, I'm told, that anybody could get into the network and make whatever adjustments they wanted. The election results could be observed and changed using remote access through high-speed Internet from any location. The primary control was SmartTech headquarters. "We have no idea what was set up in Chattanooga," Spoonamore says. "There could have been 20 Republican operatives, and from that point they could have made a direct hop to the White House. They could have been running this from the war room. Early on election day, George W. Bush and Karl Rove flew into Columbus, Ohio, to meet with Blackwell. Connell managed the setup and enabled Blackwell to study maps of the precincts and voter turnout in order to figure out how many votes they needed. A third company that Connell brought into the scheme was Triad, a major donor to Bush's campaign. They were run by some far-right Christians, the Rapp family. Triad supplied the network computers that stored all the voter registration information and hosted the County Board of Elections results on its web server. Connell admitted making GovTech, SmartTech, and Triad look like a single unit for the Ohio election returns. Congressman Conyers had written to Triad in December 2004, asking about their ability to access the vote-counting computers remotely. Triad, it seems, had changed the hard drive in the tabulator computer before the recount. The only reason to do that, Spoonamore says, would be to erase and destroy evidence of a software manipulation of that tabulator. Out of the blue, Connell called Spoonamore late in 2005. They'd never met before, but Connell had heard of the system Spoonamore developed to protect democracy advocates from being hacked in hostile overseas environments. In one such location, Connell was helping out some Christian advocacy groups. Unbeknownst to Connell, Spoonamore already knew a fair bit about him from his research into election activities and the voting machines. Connell had created websites for Jeb Bush's run for governor and for George W. in 2000. Connell's company got the first private contract to build and manage congressional email servers and firewalls. This gave him the ability and means to read documents and emails, copy data, and set up back doors. Then he did the website for Blackwell's office in Ohio. Another client of Connell's was Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, the group that went after Kerry on his service record. Spoonamore told us, "Mike was a front-end guy who built websites and really sophisticated databases to track voters. The way computers actually function and talk to each other, he didn't have the expertise and would have to work with others like the guys at SmartTech." When he and Connell first met in Washington, Spoonamore didn't reveal his own interest in the electronic voting world. The two hit it off and started working together on a couple of unrelated overseas projects. Then, when they happened to be at the same conference in London, somebody pulled Connell aside to warn him that Spoonamore was an insane guy who opposes voting machines. Connell told Spoon, "You have some people who were really nervous about you." As they became friends, Spoonamore sensed that Connell was having second thoughts about what he'd been doing for the Republicans. "Maybe you've followed some of the flap about all of those emails of Karl Rove's that somehow disappeared over time. Well, it was Connell who set up the site used by Rove for 95% of his email communication, known as GWB43.com. At the end of a private meeting in 2006, Connell asked Spoonamore what he knew about the complexity of trying to erase email. Spoon explained that in most cases, it can't be done. Connell pointed in the direction of the White House a few blocks away, saying that he'd kind of been asked to look at a challenge whether you could recover or get back emails. Spoonamore recalls, "He was fishing around for what the steps might be. I said, 'Mike, I'm involved in a lot of stuff to protect people's privacy and bank accounts, but I don't use those skills to destroy information. And I would encourage you to tell people to walk away from this, because one, it doesn't work, and two, the cover-up is always worse than the crime, Mike.'" With the 2008 election year coming up, Spoonamore decided to stop opposing things in the background and go very public. He approached Arnbeck's legal team in Ohio and offered himself as an expert witness. He also went to Connell. I basically said, Mike, there's a lot of people you work with, and frankly, some of them I've worked with as well, and with some I still do, who treat democracy as a game, where if their side wins, it doesn't matter if you cheat. Mike, I don't think you're in that camp, but I do think you've worked very closely with some of the people who are. I intend to spend some of my time and resources and reputation on making their lives uncomfortable. And I'm giving you a heads up about it. Well, Mike didn't react the way I expected. He reacted by taking my hands and asking to pray. And he said, I don't think you know how far over your head you're going to get. At that point, Spoonamore didn't know how involved Connell had been in the Florida 2000 situation. A guy named Roy Gales had been Connell's top computer expert for a long time. In the summer of 2000, Jeb Bush had appointed Gales as Florida's first Chief Information Officer, or Tech Czar, and gave him the authority to take over all of Florida's government computer systems, which included unrestricted access to all election reporting and tabulating computers used by Secretary of State Catherine Harris. Gales resigned in early September 2001 after being charged with grand theft in connection with a 1996 forgery. Learning more about this, Spoonamore invited Connell to breakfast. It went on for 5 hours. Spoonamore revealed he was going forward with attorneys, and I have no question it's going to end up in discovery on your desk. I hope we continue with our friendship, but there's a period of time when this is going to get ugly. Spoonamore described who he believed the guilty parties were, starting with Rove. You're really good at this, he remembers Connell saying. Then Connell admitted he'd gone too far, and there were things he was ready to get off his chest. A meeting was arranged with Congressman Conyers' office. The memo prepared for the House Judiciary Committee said, well before the 2000 election, one of Connell's employees created a Trojan horse software application, which when installed on one computer, allows its remote control by another computer. Prior to the 2004 election in Ohio, Connell administered and developed important parts of the Secretary of State's computer network, including the election results reporting server systems. During the 2004 and 2006 elections, Connell routed the election results from the Ohio Secretary of State's office through Smart Tech servers in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Then, at the last minute, Spoon says Conyers' office dropped the ball. Mike was going to come forward and talk about everything he'd seen and been asked to do in regard to voting machines. I even had a senior priest, who he really respected and who he'd never lie in front of, agree to come with him. I have no idea what happened. In July 2008, attorney Arnbeck asked U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey to hold onto all of Rove's emails. Rove was identified in the lawsuit as the principal perpetrator of a pattern of corrupt activity under the Ohio Corrupt Practices Act. We have been confidentially informed by a source we believe to be credible that Karl Rove has threatened Michael Connell that if he does not agree to take the fall for the election fraud in Ohio, his wife Heather will be prosecuted for supposed law lobby violations. Then, in September, Connell got issued a subpoena. His attorney, Bill Todd, who happened to also have been legal counsel for Bush-Cheney 04, said that Connell couldn't be deposed before the election because he was too busy working for the John McCain campaign. Shortly before the November election, Connell appeared with a trio of lawyers before an Ohio judge, who ordered him to give a deposition. With the election one day away, Connell denied any role in recommending the Chattanooga Smart Tech Company to Ohio officials in 2004, but he did admit for the record that his company had subcontracted with Smart Tech. This might have shaken up Rove and Company. In mid-October, Rove had an article in the Wall Street Journal headlined, Obama hasn't closed the sale. The latest Gallup tracking poll showed nearly twice as many undecided voters than in the 2004 election, Rove said. So Obama's 7.3% lead didn't necessarily mean that much. McCain, entering the final weekend of the race, predicted a come-from-behind victory based on how things were looking in battleground states, like Ohio. But then suddenly, on Monday night after Connell gave his deposition, it all changed. The new Rove electoral map predicted a 338 to 200 electoral vote margin in favor of Obama. Rove had basically done a 180-degree turn. Spoonamore told us, "I have had conversations with knowledgeable people who say that there were significant discussions as to whether or not, if they manipulated the election, they'd get caught this time. Their biggest fear, and frankly it was rightfully so, was that there were a number of us who were working to hack into the systems to watch for their hacking. Personally, I don't think they dared fix the election, because the people knew overwhelmingly that Obama was going to win. If it would all of a sudden have come back McCain, I think there would have been an outcry in the streets that would have gotten the Bilderberg types upset, if you know what I mean." So then, on December 19, 2008, Michael Connell, 45 years old, father of four, went down in the fiery crash of his Piper Saratoga II single-engine plane. He was flying back alone from a meeting in Maryland and only 2.5 miles from the Akron airport. The airplane's right wing clipped a flagpole in the front yard of an empty house before it broke up and set fire to the garage. Connell was thrown out of the burning plane and died instantly. He was an accomplished pilot, flying in decent weather. A friend told a reporter that twice over the past 2 months, Connell had canceled flights due to suspicious problems with his plane. A number of people with expertise are of the opinion that this was a hit, Ohio attorney Arnbeck told us. There is a method called electromagnetic pulse technology, where you can disrupt the electronics in an airplane, and it's very hard to detect, particularly after the fact. The motive would be that Connell was an extraordinary individual in terms of his knowledge and expertise in a fairly vast racketeering kind of conspiracy, in that it involved Karl Rove, business groups, multiple elections, and a fairly broad geography. Spoonamore says this, "I found out something about the system that Mike had on board, where he fundamentally had a system without mechanical controls that was computer-operated. Eyewitnesses on the ground say all the plane's lights turned off, the engine stalled. At that point he would have regained manual control by wire. He flattens it out and tries to fix the problem. But when he turns the engine back on, the plane guns itself and dives into the ground. So what happened? Simple. You program a chip. They change the chip that runs the plane. Despite the fact that FAA rules require you leave the site alone until daylight, completely document and photograph it, instead they pick up the entire plane and haul it to a Lockheed Martin hangar. Trust me, by the time the FAA started pulling it apart, the right chip was back in the computer." To say what happened to Connell was weird timing is an understatement. Here's a guy getting ready to be a whistleblower on the biggest series of election frauds in our history. Whether it was an accident or by design, he was silenced. Gee, what bad luck this guy had. Spoonamore, for one, is scared that if we continue with electronic voting, stolen elections are going to happen again. He says most of these companies are run by far-right evangelical Christians. A tiny group of people who call themselves Christians, but who clearly do not believe in Christ's message or our democracy, seem to repeatedly be behind every questionable voting outcome. They aren't Christians. They are fascists. Fascists who don't have the balls to go public, round people up and kill them, except on very rare occasions. Like Mike Connell. What should we do now? It's obvious that to avoid the specter of vote fraud always hanging over our elections, we've got to outlaw the electronic voting machines and return to a system where there's a paper trail. How can we not see the blatant conflict of interest that currently exists with the computer companies and the vote counters being dominated by the Republican Party? Give the Democrats enough years in power, and you can bet they'd follow the same pattern. While we're after real reform, let's finally abolish the antiquated Electoral College and allow the popular vote to prevail. And let's open the ballot and the debates to legitimate third-party candidates and break the stranglehold that big money has on the two-party system.